ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
They prayed, they preached, they rebelled. From God Forbid, this is the Religious Rebels podcast. The stories of people who defied empires and sometimes paid with their lives. From Joan of Arc's battlefield visions to Malcolm X's final revelation, we tell the stories of those who defied faith and remade it. Religious Rebels, the original disruptors. Search for God Forbid ABC wherever you get your podcasts or on the ABC Listen app.
It's a powerful decision in a person's life, the decision to live in the world wholly as who you are. Today on Big Ideas, we're coming out. Hello, Natasha Mitchell with ABC Radio National's live event show, Big Ideas. And you can find Big Ideas on the ABC Listen app. Now, you might have a coming out story, or in fact, it's probably many stories. The day you shared your identity with a lover, or your friends, your family, then there's your workplace. And for the speakers you'll meet today, there's coming out on the public stage and screen as well. Coming out is an experience that can, in fact, continue across a lifetime. It's personal, it's political, it's professional, and it also is often shaped by your generation, your culture, and much more. A really heartfelt and generous conversation ahead to mark the 40th anniversary of the LGBTIQ plus community health organisation, ACON. Nina Oyama is an Australian comedian, writer, actor and director, well known for her TV roles in Utopia, Taskmaster Australia and Deadlock. Jai Wallace is an Australian Olympic silver medalist in trampoline gymnastics. Actor Zoe Taraka starred in Australian drama Wentworth and the horror flick Talk to Me, and they've just published their debut novel, Eros, Queer Myths for Lovers. Dr. Atari Metcalf is a trailblazing trans GP from New South Wales, and they're joining host Mon Shafter, who is a Walkley award-winning journo, ABC presenter and producer, and the founding editor of ABC Queer.
Thank you. We're talking about coming out. So first up, you know, that's the journey of discovering who we are as LGBTQ plus people. And then there's that next step of sharing that truth about ourselves with the people in our lives. And as well as it being about outward expression, it's also quite an intentional and intimate act of inviting people into our personal space. So sort of goes both ways. People come out in very different ways. We do it over and over and over and over and over and over again. And sometimes folks choose not to come out because it's not safe in particular circumstances, and that's okay too. There are no rules. Nina, as a visible bisexual here with us today,
hello.
I'd like to start with you. When did you first realise you were bi, and how did you go about telling people?
Ooh, I first realised I was bi when I was 13, when I had a crush on a girl from my school for the first time. And I went to an all-girls school, and it was like a very conservative sort of school. And I remember like the first, like in the first week of school, someone pointed to another girl and they're like, she's a lesbian. And it was like quite a, yeah, it wasn't said like in a kind way, I guess. Mm. And so when I realised I had a crush on a girl, I was just like, oh. But it was so all-consuming. Like, I used to write letters to her. She knew that I existed, but she didn't know that I was in love with her.
Right.
But I think that was sort of the moment where I was like, I'm queer. Like, at the time, I was like, oh, no. And later, I was like, yeah.
What was her vibe, the crush?
She was, like, really sporty. Everyone at school had a crush on her. I found out later, because I went to a very conservative, it was, like, a selective school where, like, it was, like, 90% Asian. And so we had all this, like, immigrant sort of internalized, I guess, like, homophobia and cultural sort of stuff going on. But I found out later, like through talking to like a bunch of people in my year after we graduated, like a lot of people had come out retroactively, and then they were like, yeah, we all had a crush on the same person. She was so hot. She was like Kirsten Stewart levels of Riz. Like, it was insane. And you couldn't like express, I feel like, your queerness, but you could hug people for like a long time in the quad at lunch. And this person would always be hugging different girls for a long time in the quad at lunch. So, yeah, that was the first time I realised that I was, yeah, bisexual.
And how did you navigate, like, telling family or, you know, other people in your life?
I don't think I told my family for ages, but, like, family is a whole other thing. But I remember, like, when I was in year 10, I told my friend, we were, like, at a party, and I was like, I think I like girls the same way I like boys. And she was really, like, nice about it. And then 2 years later, I came out on... Do you guys remember formspring.me? No, okay. It was like this website from the 2010s where you could ask a question and then just you'd have to answer it. It was sort of like Twitter.
Oh, Ask FM?
Yes.
Okay, yeah.
Ask FM. It was like Ask FM, but it was called something different, okay. I think. But somebody asked me, like, if I was gay, and I remember being like, oh, I'm pansexual, like, I'm attracted to pots and pans, ha, ha, ha. I think I was a comedian at that point, like, I was starting stand-up when I was that age. And then I was like, no, just kidding, like, I like girls. And that was, like, really full-on. And then I think my, like, third sort of big moment of coming out was when I first talked about being bisexual on stage. And I remember being really nervous about that to tell people. I think I was, like, also really stoned because I got really stressed sometimes when I was doing stand-up. But, like, after I came out to a crowd for a first time, it was, like, this relief or, like, it felt so good to do. And, yeah, I don't know, that was, I think, a big moment for me.
What was the reaction to that?
The crowd, well, it was a good joke. I can't remember what the joke is. I should have written it down. But it was something about, I don't know, I can't even remember. I wish I had, like, rehearsed the bit, then I could have done it. But it was about, like, I was, like, in terms of sexuality, framing it through that taco ad where it was, like, ¿por qué no los dos? Like,
totally.
Yeah, which I think now is, like, a little bit binary. But in 2012, it was very subversive. Yeah, and people love the joke. And, like, a comedian came up to me, like, a seasoned older comedian, and he was like, I've never seen anyone come out on stage as bisexual before. And I was like, whoa, I guess I'm the first bisexual comedian. Because, like, right now, everyone's bisexual. That's a comedian. Like, I don't know, if you go to any comedy club, like, I think all the femme-identifying people on those lineups are like, hey, I'm bisexual, and I also have ADHD.
Totally.
But I was the first bisexual comedian. Yeah.
Do you find that... Is there a lot of material there for your comedy or for your other TV writing gigs, sort of tapping into your sexuality?
Yeah, I feel that. I feel like especially in terms of stand-up, I think when you're doing stand-up, like, you're sort of this version on stage that's, like, been turned up to 11. I feel like I personally, I don't do a lot of, like, relatable material. Like, I do a lot of, like, material about myself where I'm like, look, I'm such a weirdo or whatever. It's, like, things where I'm like, am I weird? And I'm not explaining this very well. But, like, you know how, like, a lot of people are like, oh, you know when you're on Tinder and you swipe it? Like, that. I don't do that kind of material. I'm like, look at this strange thing I did. Or I'll be like, look at this strange feeling I felt or whatever. And people will come up to me after the show and be like, thank you for telling us this story because that's how I feel too. I was too ashamed to say it or I was too nervous about saying it. And so, yeah it feels like a way I can say things out loud that maybe people don't say in normal human conversations.
Okay.
Yeah.
You mentioned before that you tried on pan for a while. How did you sort of land on bi or pan?
I think when I was first coming out, pan felt less sexual. Like, bisexuality to me was quite... I had, like, pornographic connotations, I think. But, like, I feel like bisexual was, like, in all the tags and it felt like this thing that's, like, if you're bisexual, you just want to have sex with everyone. Whereas if you're pansexual, like, you could create, like, an intimacy and I wanted to be, like, I'm a self-respecting person that's attracted to every kind of person. But now I'm just a bisexual because I'm horny. And I think that, like, there's a lot of stigma around the bisexual tag and I think that there shouldn't be... Even I respect people's choice to identify as pan or bi as they wish, but I think for me it sort of feels like very much the same thing.
Okay.
So I'm going with bi, but each to their own.
Owning it. Awesome. Love it. Thank you. Atari, we've known each other for a little bit now. How has your identity evolved over time?
Yeah, look, it's a interesting one. I think at some point in my life I've probably identified with literally almost every letter in the rainbow.
Wow.
So, you know, first questioning sexuality as a young person, but to be honest, I guess my earliest memories were of not feeling right in my body and questioning gender, but I didn't have a framework for that. I'm literally talking about tantrums at the age of two, about wanting to cut my hair short and be called Toby, which is not the name I chose, but and there's all these other little signs, but I was the youngest of three kids. I have two older brothers, and I just sort of, I think my family and I just dismissed it as being a tomboy. But then as I, you know, hit puberty, I was like, oh gosh, no, there's something else going on here. I still didn't have a framework. I was born in 1984, so there was no real social media or reference points at this point for me. And then I started to think, oh, maybe, because, you know, I did have attraction, I think, to multiple genders, and I was like, oh, maybe I'm just queer, and that explains it. And I realised there were lots of queer women who are also a bit more masculine. I was like, oh, maybe that's just what it is. And then I started to realise that many cis women don't necessarily share that same... I mean, there are some shared similarities, but around the body discomfort, I guess that dysphoria that I was so deeply troubled by. And it wasn't really until in the media, I think I saw Boys Don't Cry and I was like, oh, God.
Classic.
Oh, right. Okay, that's... I relate to a lot of that, but there's heaps of it I didn't relate to.
Yeah.
And so, in particular, I mean, I grew up in a pretty rough part of Perth. I was the first person in my family to finish high school. I also went to a selective school, thanks to basketball, believe it or not. And I just had this concept of masculinity that I didn't feel comfortable with. And I was like, there's a real toxic type of masculinity in Australia, especially in parts of working class Australia. I was like, well, if being trans means I have to jump into that box... Yeah. I can't be that, so then what am I? So it was a really challenging time to kind of explore what masculinity meant, and it wasn't until I enrolled in an arts degree and started to really dissect it all, and I was like, and travel a bit and meet different people and realise, oh, well, actually, cis men also struggle with masculinity, and the problem here is toxic masculinity. It's not my relationship to being more masculine or a man or trans. And so I came out, I guess, as sort of genderqueer around the age of sort of 17, 18, and then... encountered Judith Butler, and I was like, great, so I don't have to change my body, it's just a construct. But the dysphoria never went away, and it got to a point where it was really debilitating, and I had to see a doctor. And I spoke to the campus GP, who was remarkably informed, thank God, who then promptly put me in touch with the right people, and I started testosterone at the age of 22, which is now nearly 20 years. In 6 months, it'll be 20 years ago. And I guess what I underestimated in that process was just how liberating that would be for me, and how positive, profoundly positive, the effect would be in terms of that peace that I started to feel in my body for the first time. And then I started to kind of drift more towards the mask end of the gender binary. Now I center myself somewhere on trans mask. I still don't fully align to man, although I increasingly use he, him, sometimes he, they, depending on my mood around pronouns. Because for me, I think I don't fully fit into the binary of male and female. Unlike some of my binary-identified trans peers, that's a sort of difference for me. But in many ways, outwardly at least, I share a lot of that journey, and certainly in terms of surgery and testosterone and that experience of accessing gender-affirming care, I can relate strongly. So yeah, now I have a cis male partner in many ways, kind of move through the world as a gay man, really, to the external world, and I feel pretty comfortable in that space. But ultimately, I think in my heart, I'm pretty queer. Yeah.
So you work as a GP. Are you out at work, or how do you kind of navigate that?
Yeah, I am out at work. I really sought a practice that would be inclusive, but not too close to my home postcode, so I don't see the same guys on the Grindr grid. You know, like, I just need to have a little bit of distance. So I'm a 12-minute bike ride away. just the right distance. Still does intersect sometimes. And I work in... It's not explicitly a queer practice, but there are other queer practitioners. And there's a legacy from a GP who worked there before me, actually, who did lots of gender-affirming care. So I think it was already known as a safe space. And that practitioner's moved to Tasmania now, actually, and continues to do heaps of great gender-affirming care. And so when I was coming to the end of my GP specialisation training, I sought that practice out as a place to learn and to be mentored. And I enjoyed it so much that I stayed on. And that's where I practice now. So I'm out to all my colleagues. I, you know, have flags in my room. When I remember, I wear my pronoun badges, but sometimes I forget because I leave them on my shirt. And then I'm like, oh. And I really like it because it's an inclusive space where I see the huge variety of everything that you see in general practice, but I do lots of gender-affirming care there, and that's really, really lovely, and it's a beautiful wonderful privilege. And yeah, I feel very happy and relieved that I can be authentic and myself at work. And I don't have any fear of my colleagues reacting negatively, which is a huge privilege to have because it's not always that easy in medicine.
Yeah, I can imagine you being openly you must be so reassuring and comforting for some of the clients that come in.
For sure.
Yeah. Have you found that the medical world is queer and trans friendly?
Yes and no.
Okay.
I wish I could say that it is universally safe and friendly, but I encounter many people who come to me seeking support who have already been to multiple doctors and have had really negative experiences, and that's something that's front of mind. And it's not just specific to queer people. I think, unfortunately, there's medical trauma in lots of places, but I'm hearing firsthand, and I'm really familiar, having previously worked in research in this space as well, that there is a really high prevalence of experience of discrimination and harassment in healthcare settings especially. So we know that that is a common experience, and it's certainly backed up by my direct experience with patients. As a practitioner in the system, especially in the training years, like the junior doctor years are disgusting, I can tell you. And, you know, there are some pretty unsafe, I've felt a bit unsafe in some situations, so I haven't always been able to be out and vocal.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I think particularly in some of the surgical cultures. So when I've worked in neurosurgery and things like that, it's been tough.
Is that you hearing people saying bigoted or transphobic type things?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think actually it's a story I think I recall we spoke about once before, when I was a medical student assisting in a really delicate spinal procedure. And, you know, I'd had a pretty good rapport with this surgeon who was teaching me, and the chat in the operating room started to drift into quite transphobic remarks. I think the conversation started with the anaesthetist talking about how the Australian Defence Force was funding gender-affirming care, and I don't think there was any kind of... that wasn't loaded. They were just, oh, it's just a thing. Have you heard about this? And then the surgeon started to make really awful remarks, you know, pathologising trans people and implying that that's going to enforce all sorts of trauma and that they're going to be mentally disordered and just really uncomfortable things. And, you know, I thought to myself as I was holding a retractor around someone's spine, can I challenge this now? I mean, I don't think it would have been safe for me or the patient. And you have to kind of pick your battles. But it was really uncomfortable. And it was very clear that they had absolutely no idea that I was trans because I kept being invited to assist in surgeries, which I politely declined. But it was really tough. And I think, you have to really consider how to advocate and when to advocate.
Have you seen efforts to provide better education and training in that space?
Yeah, absolutely. And this is, you know, the good news story, which is that I think many medical schools are recognising that this is not well covered. And so I'm part of a small group of people who are on an advisory committee for the University of New South Wales Medical School, and they're doing like a career curriculum writing group. I think historically LGBTQ health has been narrowed to just HIV care and only HIV care, which is really important, but it also plays into stereotypes and misses huge amounts of, and also stereotypes for positive people, I might add, but it also misses the huge spectrum of diversity and needs in our community. So I think there's efforts to better embed being LGBTQ and the issues that we experience into what's called problem-based learning, which we increasingly medical schools use case-based learning to teach medicine.
Yep.
And the idea is that, you know, nobody comes to you with a single problem in a single system, both from a, you know, medical perspective, but also that person's whole self and identity. And I think that's really great to see that kind of shift and integrating people's lived experiences and identities into the work to look at cultural safety and competency. So there is a shift. And I think increasingly I feel a lot of good. I think the future is bright in terms of, if I think of my colleagues and the people I studied with and the people who are coming through this system now, I think there is change, and I have some, I guess you could call it cautious optimism.
Okay.
That's
really good to hear, and thank you for all the work that you're doing in this space too.
From quiet conversations to public declarations, ABC journalist Mon Shafter is exploring with this panel the many ways that people choose to come out on their own terms and the strength they find as they do. Mon is joined by GP Dr. Atari Metcalf, comedian Nina Oyama, actor Zoe Tarakis, and Olympian Jai Wallace, here on ABC Radio National's live event show Big Ideas with me, Natasha Mitchell. And this event marks 40 years of the community health and advocacy organisation ACON. We're shining a light on the collective and individual resilience it takes to be seen fully as you are.
Jai, today's a pretty special day, 25 years since the Sydney Olympics.
I would just say, obviously, the Olympics went for 2 weeks. The best day of the Games was my day, of course.
Okay.
Yeah. I was really lucky that I got to experience two sides of the Olympic Games.
Yeah.
The first side and the first 8 days was the real serious side of Olympics, where there was nothing but training and eating and sleeping and doing everything right. And then competition day and doing really well, and most of it's a blur.
Yep.
Okay. So that's the two sides of the Olympic story that I have.
Cool. So, of course, you won silver in trampoline back then. I was at the Games, very young person, volunteering in, like, the media unit. I didn't cover trampolining, unfortunately. I was focused on the women's basketball. Wonder why.
All the women's soccer, all the women's hockey, all the women's...
Oh, and handball, that too. That was pretty good. So 5 years after that deep Olympic experience, you came out as gay. Why was that the right time for you?
So I never chose to come out. I was gay before that. And it was through my community, through the trampoline community. It was well understood. So there was no surprise that it appeared in a newspaper article. But the reason why I probably didn't do anything before the Games, I never wanted to be known as the gay athlete, because that's just such a small part of me. It's just like the HIV that I deal with and that I live with. It's just such a small part of me. I always wanted to be known as the athlete who did really well at the Olympic Games as a trampolinist who happens to be gay and who lives with HIV. So it's just such a small part of what I belong to in the world. So that was never on the radar for me to make any announcement beforehand.
Yeah.
So the reason actually why that I decided to come out as gay was that it was going to be told to the newspapers anyway. In Melbourne. I was living in Melbourne at the time.
Yeah.
So somebody was going to go to the paper. So I decided to jump on top of it and get out in front of it. So that's pretty much the reason why.
Tell us about that. I mean, that sounds awful. So
Obviously, when you get yourself into silly situations, then people try and blackmail you and offer different alternatives to the truth that will be out there. So I decided to just jump on top of it and get out in front of the story.
And what was the response like? It was like, oh, we knew?
It's fine. I'm very lucky. I understand that I stand on the shoulders of giants through HIV and through the queer community and the gay community. So my story is one that's very lucky.
Yep.
Nobody directly has had anything negative to say about me, even through the HIV thing. I haven't had one person say anything condescending or poor to me.
Yeah, okay.
Which I understand that I'm very lucky in that circumstance because that is a very rare way that somebody's experiences the experiences that I have.
Okay. We first met back in 2012 when I was working on 7:30 and I interviewed you at that time. It was pretty soon after you'd come out as being HIV positive. Mm-hmm. Why did you feel it was important to share that information so publicly?
Yeah, so a little bit like why I chose to come out as gay. It was going to come out anyway. People found out about it.
Wow.
But because I'm good friends with Greg Louganis.
Yep.
And Greg's very famous US diver who busted his head on the diving board at the Olympics in 88. Mm. And he was HIV positive at the time, didn't come out till years later.
Yep.
But I've been friends with him for many, many years. And he was commentating for the diving at the London Games. And Piers Morgan, of all people, the conversation that he had with Piers on Piers Morgan Live or whatever the TV or radio show that he was on, it was, how are you, Greg? What's diving like in America? What are you up to? How's your husband? And how, like, HIV was so far down the track in the conversation that I thought, wow, if we've got to that point, then I'm going to reach out to the people that have been really good to me, the Sydney Star Observer, and offer them the story first.
Yeah.
So I did, and they ran with it, and it went from there.
I'm quite shocked to hear that you were going to be outed in that
both
sense
times
as well. Can you share any more about what was going on there?
Oh, well, it's just people, obviously, if you find yourself in a situation where somebody isn't happy with you, they're going to use whatever bullets they have in their belt against you. And I just found that I'm not prepared to deal with that. I'm not prepared to let somebody tell my story incorrectly. So I'll tell it my way. And if I have to jump out in front of it, I will.
Yeah. One of the things that jumped out when we did you know, meet all those years ago, just your incredible attitude, how for you it was just like, you know, it's another thing, I'm just getting on with my life, and just such utter positivity was quite inspiring back
then. Yeah. And both coming out as gay and as HIV positive, it really is, the world will continue to move forward and I'm not fighting for my life like people have in the past. So I am going to stand on their shoulders and take advantage of those struggles and the move forward that we have done to go on and better my life. But as I said, I know that I do stand on the shoulders of giants. And part of the reason why I got back into gymnastics and trampoline to help somebody stand on my shoulders and go one better than me at the Brisbane Games.
Zoe, you are such a trailblazer for trans mask visibility in film and TV in Australia and internationally as well. You know, you played a character in Wentworth, a trans guy who was sent to a women's prison. You're the first openly trans actor in the Marvel Cinematic Universe with your role in Ironheart. Like, it's you're putting it out there, and I know so many young trans and gender diverse people look up to you. What was your personal coming out adventure like, and what extra pressure was placed on you as an actor kind of navigating that as a young person?
Yeah, I mean, it was interesting because I knew I was gay from when I was like 13, and that was, you know, fortunately, because that was in 2013, you know, where the world had come a long way and it was pretty cruisy for me as a young queer person. And then when I realised I was trans, it was 2017, I think, and I'd come out as queer as a performer and, you know, felt like I'd overcome that sort of hurdle. And again, it was like, it was just so different in 2017, 18 with trans stuff, like, and queer stuff even, just feels like we've come such a long way in terms of the film and TV industry. And so then when I realised I was trans, I was like, oh my God, I have to do it again. I just was like, I don't run out of puffs. And it was significantly harder. Yeah, I think, you know, yeah, the past, what's that, 8 years in trans years feels like it's been like 40 years. And so 8 years ago, I knew one other trans actor in the country who was also my age, and that was it. So it was really kind of the blind leading the blind. And there was just no one to look to really here that I knew of. I mean, of course, there were so many people, but they were also, we were all looking for each other, I think. We just didn't know where to find each other. And I only knew like one or two trans people. And so it was spooky. Like, I just felt like I, you know, had to have some pretty confronting conversations with people, where again, because language and knowledge has become much more accessible in a really short space of time. In, you know, 2018, I was on the phone with casting directors here in, you know, in Australia, where they were just saying, I don't get it. I don't get it. I don't know what to do with you now. What do you want? Wow. You know, or just, you know, even peers, like friends, other performers just going, oh, it's just really confused. You know, just that stuff where you go, oh my God, you wouldn't dream of saying that now.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so it was definitely an adjustment. And I feel like an adjustment for the industry I was in too, kind of all playing catch up in real time. And, you know, I remember auditioning for Wentworth and it was a trans role and I was like, nah, we're not doing this. We're not doing this where we have a cis person playing a trans role. Like, there's so few of them, you know, there's sort of one trans role every 3 years here and we're not going to do that again. And I walked into the audition room and it was just me and like four white cis women. And I was like, I don't know if I would have got it if I hadn't seen that before, because it just lit this fire in my belly where I was like, oh no, I'm booking this job. And I did. and that was probably a real turning point, I think. Just the types of conversations that allowed me to have with the media, which, you know, I was 19 when we did Wentworth, and it was like big conversations to be having when you're figuring out who you are at the same time. I think that was probably one of the harder parts of it, was just going like, oh, I feel like I'm just figuring out who I am and who I want to be, but I'm also having to defend that publicly. And that's not very fun. Like, you kind of want to, you know, have that period where you're just expanding and exploring and not having to justify it in real time as well. So, yeah, it was rough, but also amazing and so very different now, which is awesome.
And since then, the range of roles that you're offered as an actor, how has that changed?
I want to say it's changed more than it has, but that's not true. I mean, to be honest, since I came out as trans, there has been a recession. Like, there has been a a war on trans people that didn't exist when I came out. Obviously, it has in our community's history, but, you know, I reckon 2023, around then, shit kicked off. And so that has impact, unfortunately. Like, you know, as much as we're like, oh my God, they're just crazy TERFs, they are. They also, unfortunately, are quite powerful. And so I have seen the impact of that in very practical ways, and in ways like, you know, how many trans stories get told every year. You know, there was a study came out that I think it was 2024, there was 3 trans characters in any film made that year, any major film. You just go like, ooh, that's not a high enough number. And so that's been part of the joy of finding writing, I think, is just going, oh my God, I don't have to sit and wait for someone to imagine a story for my community that is often flawed and often offensive or reductive or just kind of most often non-existent. I can make those stories happen and create stories and opportunities and also create worlds for us to live in that are really exciting. I think that's a thing as well, is just imagining trans stories that are like sexy and dark. And, you know, I think so often as trans people, you're either, historically we were the villain in on screen, and now it's like you're either such a small role that your gender isn't relevant, or you're a martyr, like you're a saint. Because it's like, oh, we just need to, you can't have a complex story because we just, it's like, look, it's a trans person, you know. And so I'm really interested in writing stories that are like really challenging and aren't written to garner empathy for trans people. Do you know what I mean? I don't care if you empathize with trans people or not, to be honest. Like, we're here. It's not negotiable. So I'm interested in writing stories about like complex trans experiences.
Yeah.
That are for trans people, you know.
Well, you have just written a book.
I have.
To come out.
I have.
Eros, Queer Myths for Lovers. And it's described as a sexy modern take on ancient Greek myths. Sounds very horny, I might add.
Yeah.
So has writing this allowed you to express parts of yourself that you wouldn't usually share with the world?
For sure, yeah. I think it's such a different experience to acting, where you really, your face is next to everything you say. And I've really enjoyed writing, you know, this book. It's very liberating to go, oh, what these people on the page think and feel is not a moral indication of what I think and feel. And I think that's like, there's just such a world of art that cracks open when you can play in that realm, I guess. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I'd often ascribed the morality of a character or a story to the maker, and you just go, oh, that's a narrow view of art, isn't it?
Yeah.
So it's been really fun.
Are you finding there are opportunities for trans and gender diverse people to tell their stories, like getting commissioned, getting publishing deals, that sort of thing?
Yes. The last story in the book, which is my favourite, is the story of Hermaphroditus, who is kind of our OG trans girl back in ancient Greece. And that story, I've taken the structure of the myth but placed it in the cross in the 90s, which is fun. And that story has been bought or optioned to be a play that I'm writing, which is awesome. Declan Green's directing. I will be playing Hermaphroditus as a boy, and then a trans girl will be playing Hermaphroditus as a woman in the second half. And, yeah, there's a film version. I don't know. It's just you just suddenly are in a position where you just go, oh, my God, there's all these roles we need to fill. Like, we're actually having to go, oh, God, are we going to run out of trans actors? Which has just said no one ever. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. That's super exciting. Stoked to hear about that. Yeah. You touched upon the political climate at the moment. It is a very hard time for LGBTQ plus people. We can all see what's happening in the States. It's a particularly hard time for the trans community. I'm keen to hear from you, and also Atari, like, for young people who are trans or gender diverse, navigating coming out right now is probably different to, you know, how it's, you know, people have navigated that in earlier years. What advice would you have for them in this climate?
It's a really big question, because yeah, I think it's really important to contextualise it, as Zoe has already articulated. You know, on the one hand, we've got greater visibility than maybe ever before, and we are standing also on the shoulders of, mm-hmm. of giants who have worked so hard and with such courage to build the rights we have. And I'm really speaking to the trans women of colour who really were the, you know, the backbone of the LGBTQ rights movement right from the 60s onwards and beyond. And then on the other hand, I think the words war on trans people is correct. I mean, I woke up today to a news feed that was just abhorrent with particularly what's happening in North America, but that's not just confined to North America. We've got really well-organised groups in Australia seeking to dismantle the very recently won rights and access that you know, we've just been granted and are still working on. So it is a really tough time, because I think for young people there is this sort of intense contradictions, you know, and I think hopefully increasingly I am seeing many young people come with the support of families and friends, and in their worlds it's okay. I mean, I say this from practicing in the city, Sydney, but there are, and I still encounter and support people who have got deep hostility at home, the real threat of violence from within their families and their communities, the difficulty of insecure housing and discrimination in employment. And so my advice is, it's your journey, and the time to declare things publicly to other people. It's okay to decorate the closet and make it as fabulous as you need to until it's safe to come out. And I think for everyone here who's a supporter of or has a lived experience of bubbles of safety where people can just be themselves and create space to hold people, because it is a tough time right now. And you know, I feel it personally as well. You know, it's really, really challenging to see so much hatred in the media and elsewhere, and have our bodies and our lives constantly politicised. And I think, to echo the words of another wonderful human, Teddy Cook, who does so much phenomenal work and advocacy, I've had the pleasure to work with over many years. He said, you know, for those who don't know us, you know, we deserve the dignity to be known. I think those were the words in a speech to Parliament a few years ago when advocating for inclusion programs in schools to help people understand our experience. We're vilified and people are not well understood. And I think for those of us who feel confident and safe to be out, then absolutely use your privilege to do so and be visible and vocal and demonstrate that we are human beings with multifaceted lives. It's one dimension for some of us. It's a big dimension for many of us. But whether the choice you make about that is also dynamic, and you can go in and out. I think that's actually the theme of today, as you need to and as it's safe to. And I think respecting other people's choice as well is important. So this is something that, you know, we've heard today sometimes gets taken away from us, or we're put in positions where you really need to control your story, and that's really difficult. So I think my advice is take your time. You don't have to tell everyone. It's a privilege to invite people in and to share. If you feel safe to do so, you can make a massive impact, I think, on others by just being, by existing. But it's, yeah, safety first, and respect. Everyone's at a different stage in their journey. Mm.
Did you want to add anything to that, Zoe?
I mean, that's pretty well said, isn't it? I feel something that helped me and still helps me is, yeah, like you said, just really looking to the people who did it first. And there is no way forward without looking backwards. And
but look at the risks they took.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. Look at the violence that they stood against. Yes.
And it's cyclical, you know, and you look at, like, the stuff that Marsha and Sylvia were saying in the 60s, you know, and it's like, it still applies, you know. I often think of that speech that Sylvia Rivera gave when she, the Y'all Better Quiet Down speech, where she kind of just looked at these gay men and she stood in front of them after being pushed off the stage, and she came back up and she was like, I have lost my house, my job, my everything for gay liberation, and where are all of you for us, you know? And I think that's still a conversation that needs to be had. Like, we do need our other queer allies, you know, kind of standing beside us at the moment, because it's dark out there and it's dark for all of us, you know, and so we're just stronger when we stand side by side, I suppose. But yeah, I find a lot of peace and a lot of comfort in looking to particularly those OG girls, you know, like Crystal Love, Auntie Crystal Love and Chantel Martin, you know, so many women here as well, women of colour, trans women of colour, who just did it harder and did it earlier and are still here to tell that story. And so, yeah, I would always recommend looking back to go forward.
Yeah. I mean, this also really highlights the importance of the work that ACON is doing, connecting our communities, providing safe spaces for us to connect and to care for our health and well-being. It's just more essential than ever right now. I mean, obviously, we've had a huge history of gay and queer rights, but it just feels like, you know, now's the time to really step up. I'd love to hear from each of you. Can you tell me about a time when you've realised that by being out, you've made a difference in someone's life, and that might be feedback you've received, an interaction you've had with someone. But do any examples come to mind? Jo, you're an Olympian. Like, surely you've had people reach out to you.
Yeah, so to be honest, not many people do reach out, because I think they see, in my sporting world, they see my achievements as a bridge too far, because it's damn hard to do what we achieved. It takes a lot of time, a lot of sacrifice, and we live in very much a world where there's a participation certificate for everything that you do, where back when we were doing it, we got none of that. It was just nothing but balls down, hard work. So the next generation of athletes, there's one standout, and his name's Brock Batty, and he's out of Melbourne. And every time he sees me, he comes over and he says, I want to be better than you. I'm going for that one step better than you. But that's him saying, I see your achievements, I appreciate what you do for us, and I'm chasing down your legacy. And that makes me feel nice, because that's what you do it for, right? You do it so somebody will come along one day and do it better than you.
Yeah, yeah.
This event, marking 40 years of the community health organisation ACON, looking backwards, looking forwards, thinking about what's been achieved and what else needs to be done. Founding editor of ABC Queer, journalist Mon Shafter, is talking coming out with the comedian Nina Oyama, actor Zoe Tarakis, GP Atari Metcalf and Olympian Jai Wallace. From fear to freedom, isolation to community. This is a conversation about truth, about courage and connection.
Atari, I imagine, you know, again, with the clients that you see, you would be making a pretty significant impact in the lives of people. Are there any examples you can share?
Oh, look, I feel really privileged because I get to work with and meet so many trans and gender diverse people and people from our community every day. And I think I get huge amounts of reward and satisfaction from seeing people come into themselves and feel good about themselves, and that speaks volumes to me about the importance of this work. An example that kind of sticks with me and to some degree haunts me from my junior doctor days, when I was, you know, working a night shift in the emergency department in a big hospital, I got called to chart some pain relief for a trans man who was experiencing some really significant difficulties and was suicidal. And this young patient, you know, clocked me in, this is COVID era, so it's in like the pandemic gear, like the space suit, and I therefore couldn't be wearing my little pronoun badge. And I saw from the request, the nursing staff had asked, can you chart some pain relief? This person was having menstrual pain, and this was pretty tough for him, because obviously that's a huge world of dysphoria for so many reasons. And in a hospital setting, seeking pain relief for this is fraught with lots of fear about having to disclose. And there I was, this seemingly cis passing white dude coming to like chart pain relief and having to take a history about their pelvic pain, which he was just like, no, I don't want to talk about this with some white guy. And fortunately, when I was getting dressed into all the PPE, saw a little label and it's meant to write your title. And so I put my pronouns on a sticky piece of paper, like a little sticker, and put it on the PPE and then walked in. And that was a little safe signal and it just changed everything. And then, you know, this young man was potentially about to discharge into a really unsafe environment because it was struggling to get the care they needed, and partly because they didn't feel safe to really tell the medical staff what was going on. And so by being able to signal some safety, we were able to have a conversation and address the needs. And then he remained in the ward and was able to then get the care he needed. And I think that, to me, was a really important moment to remind me that, you know, visibility really matters and those small gestures can actually change the course and trajectory massively. Yeah.
Wow, I mean, the pronoun, that really moved me.
Yeah, just a little thing.
Yeah.
By being, you know, out in such a public way, have you found that people have connected with you on that level? I'm not talking about, like, trying to hook up with you, but
I mean, they do that too.
Like, it has been really good going to comedy shows and, like, hearing people, because I always, like, when I've done festivals and stuff, like, you do stand outside and have conversations with everyone that attended, because it's such a privilege to, like, perform for people in that capacity and also to have an audience that wants to pay to go and see you. Like, so I want to talk to everyone, and people are, like, very happy to be represented by me, which is very nice, because I think of myself as a worm and I'm like, why? It's been really, like, heartwarming. And I think as well, like, I do a lot of television writing. It's actually how I make most of my money. It's very cheeky, actually. But, like, I'm always just trying to, like, put in bisexual characters or queer characters where I'm just like, come on, push them through. And I think my greatest triumph was I worked on a show called Koala Man for Disney, and it was like an Australian and American animation co-production, and me and another bisexual girl on the staff, we kept pitching this, like, the main daughter, sort of the Lisa Simpson character, to be queer, and, like, kept pitching this storyline. But we had, like, a group chat going. We'd be like, you say this and then I'll say this. And we, like, teamed up to create this character called Allison, who, yeah, her journey is, like, less about coming out, but it's it was just really fun to be. We were in this, like, group of men, basically, like, just boring, nerdy cis men, and we were just like, come on, like, let's make it gay. And they were very lovely about it, and they put that storyline in. And then it was played by Demi Lardner, who's another bicon. So, yeah, that was a cool triumph for us. Yeah.
Cool. Thank you. What about you, Zoe? Have people reached out to you?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, there's this tiny guy called Nick, who's this little trans 15-year-old he's Indigenous guy in Canada. And he, like, we do, like, Wentworth cons where, you know, you go and it's like a good little cash grab. And you kind of, you know, go and meet some fans or whatever, and then you get a holiday in New York or whatever. And
sweet.
He came to the one I did this year, and he's just, like, I don't know. I think so much of the time I can be a bit pessimistic with acting, because it's just like, oh, my God, what are we doing? You know, how is this changing the world or making it a better place? And then I think, you know, when you see beautiful little trans people who had never seen anybody on TV before who was anything like them, in the same way that I had never seen a trans person on TV before until, you know, less than 10 years ago probably, or 10 years ago, you just go, oh, that actually does count for something. Mm-hmm. And I can, yeah, like, totally, you know, convince myself that it doesn't, or that, you know, like, I think a lot, a common thing that actors say to each other is, like, you know, we're not saving lives here. Like, don't take it too seriously. The fact is we're not, you know, like, it's not what...
Well, visibility, you know, is quite important.
But, yeah, but I think it is, you know, it is important to remember that visibility is important, and that, you know, having not just one version of transness, or, you know, not just the Hunter Schafers or Elliot Pages, but, like, a really wide, expansive version of what transness is, told through many bodies and many experiences and many cultures, is so important, you know, because I think a lot of us as well, still a lot of the trans rep is, like, very white, very passing, very thin, And it's amazing that it's there at all. Like, that's a win for sure. But I'm really excited to see a bigger range of trans bodies up there and trans faces, because, like, you know, you walk into a club or a party and it's just you just know two people are anything alike. And so, I'm excited for that to be reflected and just go, there is such a vast expanse of people in this community and stories in this community that I feel we just haven't even scratched the surface of, which is exciting, you know? So I'm like, come on, everybody. Put your money where your mouth is. Make it, you know?
I know the coming out experience can be more or less challenging depending on who you are, where you're based, the circumstances around you. But this is to all of you. Do you foresee a future where one day coming out isn't really a thing? We just are who we are?
I think that's the goal, right? That would be the goal. It's just it doesn't matter anymore. But until we get to that point, then you'd need to celebrate everybody that is brave enough to tell their story openly and publicly.
What are your thoughts, Atari?
Yeah, I think we are heading in that direction. And I think we're reflecting on, like, young people. We're talking backstage about kids and how they say how it is and how adept and chilled they are about understanding this diversity. They get it. And I think, yeah, the future gets it. And I do think that is a place that we'll get to. It's not without the need for some really serious advocacy and work to go. You know, we're not there yet, and I think we have to protect what has already been fought and push forward. But I think the future is really bright.
Anyone else like to add anything to that one?
I feel like kids are such a... Yeah, we were talking about it. The kids are just such a life-affirming force. Like, to answer that question, I was at the park on a slip and slide, so in like a Speedo in Darwin, as you do with my partner and their kids. And there was this, like, you know, 7-year-old boy that was playing with us, and we were slipping down the slip and slide, and he just looked at me about an hour into playing, just went, "Are you a boy or a girl?" And I was like, "I'm a boy." And he was like, "Cool." You know, like, it's just that simple. And this is like, you know, this is up in Darwin where there's not as much access to language or, you know, those conversations as a big city. And so I don't know, I'm just constantly, like, conversations with kids just make me feel so settled. Like, I'm like, we're going to be fine. Yeah, my partner's kid was walking with a friend of mine who has had top surgery, and she just looked at them and went, "So, you chopped your boobs off." You know? Just like, all good with me. You know, like, there's not that layer of, like, even just the layer of, you know, that caution that can sometimes feel condescending, you know? It is just none of that. It's just like...
Well, I think discrimination and phobia are learnt.
Totally.
Process, right? People learn how to do that from others in the future. Kids are perfect examples of that, because it's not ingrained, it's not innate in our nature to look at anybody any different than, okay,
you're
slip a human. And slide. You're here, I'm here, let's go play.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
It's a learned behaviour.
Yeah, and also because stuff like pronouns is so accessible to kids now, you know, and I've been doing a bit of teaching acting, and I coach this 11-year-old who, anytime we play like a story game where we tell a story and you have to remember each line and go back and forth, and she's always like, "And she or he or they goes to the park," and I'm like, "You're 11. That's crazy." You know, it's just, it's not even like it. She's not doing it to be politically correct or to be polite because I'm there. It's just how her brain works, you know. And so I think that's awesome. And, like, you know, you were saying, it just really puts us in good stead for it to not be a thing.
It's so true. Look, as the parent of a 2-year-old, I can say the kids are all right.
The kids are all right.
And on that note, I'd just like to thank you all for coming today, and happy 40th, Akon. We love what you do. We're so proud of you.
Akon has certainly travelled a long road across its 40 years, four decades, since 1985, born out of the devastation of those early years of the HIV/AIDS crisis. Today it's one of Australia's leading rainbow health organisations, supporting the LGBTIQ+ community. And you heard today from founding editor of ABC Queer, journalist and producer Mon Shafter. Hosting this discussion with comedian Nina Oyama, actor Zoe Tarakis, GP Dr. Atari Metcalf, and Olympian Jai Wallace. My name is Natasha Mitchell. Thank you so much for joining us today. I'll be back with you, with more big ideas. See ya.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.